for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 661 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week it's time for another very special doubleheader episode, and it all kicks off with DC's Absolute Batman creators Scott Snyder and Nick Dorgata. Then it wraps up with indie great Phoebe Xavier. Everything kicks off with my terrific interview featuring the return of Scott Snyder, this time with artist Nick Dorgata, who are taking The Dark Knight Where No Batman Has Gone Before, starting this Wednesday, October 9. Here's how the book is described. If there's one big Batman comic news story of the year, it is without a doubt Absolute Batman. We talk about how this new take on Batman came to be, who the various characters are, and then we get some hints on what Scott and Nick have in store for us in the months ahead. Then it all concludes with the return of Phoebe Xavier to the podcast, who is kickstarting the third volume of the 13th Moon anthology series. Here's the description. It's a comic book horror anthology with six stories by a variety of talented teams. Phoebe discusses how this book came to be, who the characters and creators are, and what else 123 Go has coming soon. Be sure to back this excellent crowdfunder before it concludes on Friday, November 1 at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they all have to say. There's a lot to get to in this special episode, so let's get on with the show. Batman legend Scott Snyder and iconic artist Nick Dorgata transformed the Dark Knight's tale for the modern age. Without the mansion, without the money, without the butler, what's left is the absolute Dark Knight. And boy, is it off to a great start. And today I'm talking with creator Scott Snyder. Welcome back to the podcast, Scott.
Well, it's great to be here, Wayne. Thanks so much for having me.
And I want to welcome to the podcast Nick Dorgata, who is the artist and also, I think, a co-creator, if I'm not mistaken, on Absolute Batman. How you doing, Nick?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me, Wayne.
It's good to talk with you guys. I haven't been this excited about a comic, I think, since the last time Scott Snyder wrote a Batman comic. It's just tremendous stuff. I had the opportunity to read a preview copy of it, and I have to say right off the bat, I truly loved it.
Thank you.
Now, see, the thing to me is some people are fussing, you know, there are people who are continuity buffs. If Batman puts his batarang in a certain pouch, it's always got to be in that pouch. I'm not that kind of a guy. I want to see other stories. I wrote a column at Major Spoilers that I talked about the fact that Batman was going to marry Catwoman for a while. And I was looking forward to it because, man, here's a chance to see something different. I haven't seen Batman married before. Except for like Earth 2. So for me, I was really happy to see that. And then when it didn't happen, I was really disappointed. So when I heard about this coming, I said, oh, different. I like different. I can't wait to see how this goes. So, Scott, I do have to ask you, Scott. I read one time someplace where you said there was a Batman story you wanted to tell that you would come back to do. Does Absolute Batman contain that story?
Yeah, it is that story. 100% it is that story. For me, you know, I've wondered for a while what I would do with Batman if I got to write him completely out of continuity. And, you know, I think a lot of the time the temptation is to be like, he would be, what if he's a medieval knight, which I love that book, by the way. Or like, what if he's, you know, another favorite? What if he, grows up in Russia? But for me, it was always, what if you could reimagine the entire origin and every aspect of it to be more resonant or more exciting for you at this moment in a way that would sort of pit him against the things you're most afraid of. Like, how would you adjust him to make him more purely himself? And so that was the challenge, you know, if Batman ultimately is a figure who exists to help us face our fears, right? He's a kid that goes up against the most terrifying thing possible with the death of his parents, and then says, I'm going to use that as fuel to make sure that I can make the world better and that this doesn't happen. How do you apply that formula and that character to today? That means, like, well, you know, it, maybe he'd be even more Batman if you take away some of the resources, meaning, you know, he'd be even more inspiring if he didn't have some of that. Well, maybe it means that the trauma that forms him would be something that's a little bit more immediate for kids today and parents today. And so that's where it really came from. It was always, if I had the chance to redo Batman from the very beginning, what would make him even more Batman? What would make him absolute? And that's really where it came from.
Well, I have to say, are you guys' reaction to the order numbers so far? Nick, what was your reaction when you started to hear those numbers coming in?
Oh, I mean, it's insane, because I don't think Scott and I had any idea what to expect. Like, we knew creatively we're taking a chance, but I think as Scott and I got into actually making the book, like, we were like, this is good, regardless whether it sells or not, or people think it's good. Like, I, as an artist, I'm like, this is definitely one of the best things I've ever worked on. Like, I really believed in it. And when you see all the hoopla online about the design or the size or the look, and it was almost like we're just, you know, laughing at it, because we're like, wait till you read it. All these questions will be answered. And then just to start seeing all the fan art, I could sense, wow, we're tapping into something. And then the orders started coming in, and it's like, okay, now we're really hitting on something. And it's just energizing. I mean, it's awesome, because Scott and I are really going into this with a lot of enthusiasm. And I feel like all of the comic scene is like catching on to that enthusiasm too. And I mean, I just read the Absolute Wonder Woman book, and it's fantastic. And I can't wait to read Jason's Superman. So it's just like all of us, I think, are pretty inspired working on this line.
Now, Scott, I got to ask you, you have taken a lot of chances with Batman over the years. Have you gotten to the place now where you kind of expected this reaction, or did this surprise you again?
Oh, this absolutely. Everyone will vouch, like, this definitely surprised me. I mean, I've been in, you know, creator-owned comics land for the last 4 years, and, you know, people have seen a lot of Batman from me. And so my aspirations, like, again, were, like, very, very, like, low, honestly, in terms of sales. It wasn't about how high, you know, is this book going to sell. It was about trying to make the best book possible as part of an initiative whose spirit was all about every single creator taking their biggest swing. I mean, we started talking about All In almost 3 years ago. It was when I was away and working in Creator Own that, you know, the idea came to me and Josh to try and create an initiative that would bring the excitement that we felt when we did the New 52 and Rebirth, but do all of it at the same time. And it was all supposed to be a testament to trying to show people, not like give, you know, give kind of the mainstream culture the finger, but there was definitely a sense of anger about it, where it was like the conversation was so much about how superheroes were over. There was a malaise. There was this, you know, all these autopsies about superhero universes at that time. So it felt like, you know what, not only are superheroes alive and well in comics, but they're living out some of their best stories as we speak, from Venom to Immortal Hulk to All World's Finest, the Nightwing, and on and on and on. So it just felt like, let's do an initiative that embraces every single kind of superhero storytelling at once, that gives you the boldness of the New 52, the reimagining of characters, but also has a story that sort of allows for jumping on points all across the line. And every single book will be a welcome mat. Every single book will be like a jumping on point for readers that have been there, and also for new readers. And so my aspiration with this was, if I was going to tell everybody at DC and fly out there multiple times to be like, you're taking your biggest swing, right, creators? Like, whatever that swing is, you have 2 years to get it ready, or a year and a half. Maybe that's on the book you're already on. Like Tom King on Wonder Woman, it was like, I have this huge arc I want to do about the baby and all of this. That's in October. Or it was someone wanting to try something new, like Tom Taylor on Detective Comics, which is unbelievable, by the way. Once you read it, it's such a good story. And so it was like, what is that for me? Well, like, as silly as it sounds, because I've done so much Batman, or as paradoxical as it sounds, for me, the biggest swing I could take was doing this story that I'd had in my head for a long time about, you know, making Batman something brand new to me and doing it in a place where it's very easy for people to be like, we're tired of you, or you're going back to the well. So you have to prove them all wrong and be like, this is the thing that is the biggest challenge is to do Batman in a way that could stand next to the stuff that I've done before with a partner who's going to elevate everything I do and just bring his own fire to it and passion to it and make something that feels absolutely different. So it's apples and oranges from anything you've seen from me before. And that's really what it was with Nick. So, but the sales are amazing. Like, I never expected that. I mean, I was honestly, like, full disclosure, like, I was hoping for like a third of what we sold. So, and it's still going up, which is crazy. I just, you know, it's still going up, which just blows my mind. So I'm not going to say what they are, but on Absolute Wonder Woman, the initial sales today were over double what we had hoped too. So it's just like, it's just out of control. It just shows that people are really responding to creator-driven licensed work right now. You see it in Dan Johnson's Transformers. You see it over in Turtles, you know, with Jason Aaron and them and all the great artists over there. And you're seeing it at DC too. And you're seeing it at the Ultimate Universe at Marvel. There's just a feeling and an excitement around books where it feels like creators are really taking risks and big swings with these characters that we know and love. So I don't know, just seeing fans show up for it this way, we just want to party. That's why it just feels like we get to go out and celebrate with them over the next couple of weeks and go to some signings and say thank you and buy some pizza and beer and say thank you. Only if you're of age.
Well, I have to tell you, there were so many surprises in that first issue. And I would not in any way spoil any of them because I want people to get the experience that I had. I was so shocked at some of the stuff that came along. And boy, do I want to spoil it, but I'm not going to. It's the thing that's fun for me is I look at it like from a storyteller perspective, things happen. I go, oh, that's interesting. That means things are going to be different now. And boy, they were really good. I do have to bring up the one thing that still drives me crazy is the axe. I'm looking at this. I look at the logo. So I've seen crazier Batman logos than that. But all this fuss going on. And then I loved your comment on X, Scott, about how it grows 1% every time you complain about it. I thought, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity. And boy, I thought if people want to argue and fuss about that, that's free advertising for you guys. So I thought, man, you have struck a nerve is what's going on. What was your reaction to it all, Nick?
I mean, Scott called me when all that went down. I was oblivious to it. I'm not on social media much. And then, yeah, I mean, Scott just kind of had a laugh because, again, you read the book and you then read it and go, okay, now I get it. And it's also a storytelling tool. Like, I want to serve Scott's story with my design work. And it just, the Baroque bat didn't fit his chest. He's too big. And then everything for him is practical. He's using it. He is a utility in and of himself when he is Batman. Every part of him becomes a weapon. So, We were almost laughing as it's happening because we're just like, well, when they read it, and it's just, you've read the book, Wayne. So it's like, you kind of, you can look at it now and go, wow, that was kind of a silly conversation, or these people will get it once they read it. And doing work, like Scott was saying, we're being so collaborative with it and we're really thinking through every decision. So none of this is really superfluous or like, you know, we hope we're not, you know, going down some dead end path, but like a lot of this is thought out and it just, that design and that shape fit the character and it's big. And to me, it's bursting at the seams. And now we all know it's really dangerous too. So like, I love it even more.
DC called to be like, you know, we're sorry that, cause I didn't know they were going to isolate the logos and like release them as that, which I'm happy they did. But so they called to be like, oh, we're sorry if it caused like a storm online of criticism. And it was like, are you kidding? Do you want to do an interview or anything to like set it straight? And it was like, no, this is amazing. Are you kidding? I'm so glad you did. Because again, it just feels like one of the big problems that superhero comics and comics in general has in this age, I feel like, is piercing the veil of just like endless noise on social media and also like malaise. Like there is a sense not about superheroes being boring or any of that, but you're just you're in a wash of like so many news cycle stories just coming. So to be able to capture their attention and have them yelling about it, or, you know, loving it or hating it, like just have them engage means a lot. It means they're paying attention. And like, if you love your story, like we love this story and feel really confident, it doesn't really get into your skin. It's more just like, awesome, you know, great. Talk about it.
Well, you know, it reminded me of when Ben Affleck was picked to be the Batman actor. They told him not to go online because there's going to be negative stuff about it, but he went anyway. And the first thing he went, he says, Ben Affleck now is Batman. No! Went across. And I got a kick because he's turned into my favorite of the Batman movie.
Yeah, he was great. It was funny. Someone posted a snippet of Michael Keaton as Batman. And it was like, it looks like we're getting a kitschy comedic Batman from Burton. You know, and it was the same kind of hating it before they even knew what they were going to do with it. And but that's just the internet, you know, like it's, I don't take it anything seriously.
Even if they hate it when they read it, it's okay. I feel like, I mean, you hope it doesn't happen, but like I showed Nick like this screenshot on my desk that's like, you have ruined Batman for me. I am never coming back to this book. Ever. Like, I'm dropping it now. Like, you've destroyed the legacy. And it was someone writing a letter about Batman Year One. It was just like, literally, like, you've made it so dark. Nobody, there'll be no coming back from this, you know? And it was just like, you know, it's okay. It's all right.
Well, I as a fan of one of the Batman family characters, I was so happy to see Alfred come back.
Mm.
I love what you're doing with Alfred. I mean, I've always wondered why he wasn't more of an action character, because he's been in MI6 before, and he's a butler just walking around handing people drinks. He could do so much more, and the anime cartoon did some of that. But you guys have taken him to absolute Alfred.
Yeah, I told Scott, Alfred needs his own book. Yeah, he's awesome. I love him. I love drawing him in this book. Yeah. Scott, you should talk about where he comes from and just.
I will, yeah. The funniest thing was when we were at San Diego and they showed the first images of him, I was like, they were showing it when we were not, I was like in the audience coming up at that moment. And this person was like, why is Alfred hot? I was like, awesome. But the idea, Alfred is secretly like, not just sort of the main character of the first arc where his sort of emotionality is the driving force of the first five issues, but he's kind of my point of view. Like he's the point of view character he narrates, but he's somebody who is older and has been around the world and is a bit jaded or quite jaded and cynical and comes to Gotham on a mission that he's sort of is par for the course for him. And he crashes into this like young, idealistic, crazy kid being Batman, thinking he can change the world. And no matter how many times Alfred tries to explain to him or convince him that he shouldn't be doing this because there's no hope in changing the world, the kid will not stop. And that's why he's so big. And he's like a battering ram coming at all your expectations. And as such, Alfred starts to change. Like Alfred starts to, you know, become like more... a little bit more hopeful, a little bit more wild, a little more dangerous, a little more like maybe we can. And so it's kind of like watching your kids, you know, who you have teenager now, I have two teenagers, but one is 17 going off to college, you know, next year. And there's a sense of like, God, I can't believe the world we gave them. It's so politically divisive and it's so, you know, on the precipice and there are all these challenges we didn't have. And it looks so worrisome in so many ways. And then they go into it with this belief that not only are they going to do well, but they're going to just change those things and they can do better than the systems that we've left them and that they deserve better and can make better things. And there's a kind of just ballsiness to that and then just out there belief system that is what this Batman stands for. You know, it is like, no, I'm not settling. No, I'm not going to compromise. I'm going to go right at you with my bat axe and like break down the things you think I can't and, you know, build something better on the other side. It's why he's an engineer. It's about building new things. And so that whole feeling is just like, that's really the spirit of it.
Well, I saw a younger fan who was talking about what he's seen. He said, you know, I says, now Batman is cool.
Yeah, I keep seeing TikToks about him. And I'm like, oh my God, my kid, my 17-year-old keeps showing me these TikToks where people like, you know, like absolute, but I'm absolute, you know, it's like the joke of how big he is and Batman lifts and all that stuff. It's like, but yeah, the kids seem to really like him, which is awesome.
Did- Did you see the cosplayer that actually built the detachable axe?
No, I haven't seen
it yet. It's rad. He's like, he figured it out. You know, like I told Scott, like, we're going to see someone walk in on the bat stilts at a show one day. Like, we are going to see this absolute Batman fully idealized. And it's rad. We're feeding off of it, no doubt.
I love the cape, I have to say, because, you know, I remember the days when Batman's cape was just like a towel laying on his back. And then all of a sudden it became its own living creature swirling around him and stuff like that. The fact that it's actually functional and has something to for him to use, I like that. I was like, man, I've been wanting to see a cape like that forever. That is just the greatest thing.
Yeah, well, we grew up in the 90s, so it was like, you know, the desire to have that big, you know, epic McFarlane cape, and then having to tamp that down. Nick was great, because the first idea I had for the cape was even wilder, where it was sort of based on tech that he would have had, Bruce would have had help from Edward Nygma, who's his friend in this, like, to build that would have been reactive and kind of nanotech, so that it could harden, it could, you know, it could sort of do things like with, you know, some limitations, but it could do things almost like that he had programmed into it, like a programmable fabric. But and it was really cool, and it looked awesome. But ultimately, Nick was really right, where it was like, he can't have high tech stuff. It's got to be real basic, because he's, no matter who his friends are, no matter where, that you want it to start off at a level that feels like it's all DIY, it's all utilitarian, it's all, you know, rough and tumble. He's super resourceful, super smart, but it's not like what the main Batman has. And so That changed. But yeah, we had some crazy cape designs early on. My fault.
Scott, you know, the impetus too, Wayne, was to go back to the silhouette and making it scary. So the hooks and making them kind of organic. And I remember when Scott and I were on the phone, and we just started talking about like Bob Kane's original designs. And I remember that Da Vinci drawing, what they say he was inspired from. And then Scott, we one day on the phone, we're like, let's look at bats. And we looked at bats, and they have hands and walk on their hands. And, you know, it was just like, all right, here, this is it. This is it. It looks creepy. It's, you know, these fingers that they have, he's going to have those at the ends of each seam. The seams can tether, come back together to give us that bat silhouette. And just like all these possibilities started forming when we looked at like the real biology of a bat. And it was really cool to like now work that in.
Well, it's really terrific. I have to say that. And the thing that it does to me, though, is I have no idea what you guys have in mind next. I mean, everything I see, I'm shocked when I look at this stuff. I like I said, there's so much I could spoil, but I won't. But I just have to say, even the bad guy in this issue surprised me. And I don't know if it's been released who that person is, but I won't say anything about it. But I thought, you know, you talk about absolute Batman, you're making the villains absolute as well. Really shocking and really surprising. Well, I do have to say one thing, too. There's Batman. If you're a bad guy going against Batman, you better hang on to all your digits.
Yeah. This guy, he is a little more violent. He's a little more brutal, but. You know, again, like we thought really long and hard. Actually, the violence of it was the thing we probably went back and forth on the most. But every aspect of the book is really deliberate and considered. And ultimately, where we landed was like, he doesn't have a lot of the theatrics of the other Bruce. He doesn't have like EMPs and things that can disable everything. And so in some ways, there's a performative aspect to the way that he fights. He wants it to be non-lethal, but it also has to be bloody, and it has to be like, you don't want to mess with me. You know what I mean? And so there's a utility to that mindset, where he's like, I'm not going to hit any artery, but I'm going to hit you where you might bleed a lot in front of, you know, so that it looks like, you know, no one wants to go up against me. And so that sort of very, very kind of targeted violence for him is all part of his construction of Batman.
Yeah, and Wayne, I would add, like when I say we don't know where it's going, I say that from the perspective of all of the possibilities. Like when Scott and I talk and you have, you know, 80 years of Batman mythology to pull from and then to switch up, there's so many possibilities and storylines that Scott and I have like already conjured up that I'm like, that's not going to happen until issue 30. You know, like, it's just so, there's so much. And in that regard, I don't know what's next. But I'm just so excited to kind of get to it all at the same, like, there's so much meat on this bone, and it's been so much fun.
Well, like I said, you know, it used to be with Batman, it was kind of predictable. I knew what kind of things he was going to do. But now, like I said, I have no concept what's going to come. And one thing I do want to mention is you have made Batman scary again. You know, Batman for a long time has always just kind of been a do-gooder and Adam West kind of stuff. This time, I, you know, what he did in that first issue, I never expected. So what's going to happen next is, but see, I like not knowing. I like it when I can't tell what's going to happen. That makes me want to read it more, not less.
Awesome.
That's the fun, is we wanted him to feel wild, dangerous. And like every issue, Nick and I are talking about how can we be true to this version of Batman? And yet at the same time, like, do something, you know, in as true to this version of Batman that does something you've never seen Batman do before. Like, you know, what does he do that main universe Batman wouldn't do? What is his Batmobile versus that? Maybe he travels the country at one point. Maybe he does this, that just places and, you know, just sort of actions and things that main Bruce wouldn't do because he's from a different background. He's up against a different world in the main universe, but he's also just, he doesn't come from an outsider's perspective. He's not someone looking in to that room where Bruce can easily walk in and be like, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you dined well, and, you know, and all of that. This Bruce doesn't know anything about that world, but he's up against it. So how does he, you know, every aspect of him is new and exciting to us.
Well, I have to say that can't wait for people to actually read the issue like I did. I bet the reaction is going to be like mine. I was blown away, and like I said, I haven't been this excited for a Batman comic in a long, long time. So I have to congratulate you guys. Boy, I can't wait to see what you guys have next. So thanks so much for talking with me about Absolute Batman number one.
No, thanks, Wayne. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Take care, Wayne.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome back to the podcast Phoebe Xavier, who is the co-founder and editor of 123 Go Publications, and she's also the creator of the Trouble character. And there's a new episode of that character coming our way, and it also looks like a new book in the 123 Go Publications is coming, the 13th Moon Anthology series. So how's it going, Phoebe?
It's going well. Thank you for having me back on, Wayne.
It's good to talk with you again. Why don't you update us on what's going on 123 Go Publications since the last time we talked?
Sure. I don't know if we were talking about Vikings last time I was on, but that was a successful Kickstarter. Good. Viking Saga was the last book we put out. Okay. The last one we kickstarted. I think I put 13th Moon Volume 2 and Gunmetal Black Ops Volume 4 out also since then. So a couple books in this past year. And now, yeah, we're kickstarting 13th Moon Volume 3. It is our Halloween anthology book, and this will be the third volume. First one was a successful Kickstarter, and we're going to try to go 2 for 3. Right now, yes, Trouble does have a story in this book, and it is Trouble versus Cthulhu. She is my reluctant hero. She is a superhero of sorts in a futuristic world where she lives on the moon in the 2400s. And yes, so this was actually a story that I had written as a pitch to the Kickstarter series Cthulhu is Hard to Spell, and it did not make the cut in that anthology, but I was like, well, this is still a great story, so let's put it in my own Halloween anthology. And so we have that one and five other original stories this year for 13th Moon Volume 3.
Okay. Now, when does the Kickstarter begin and when does it end?
It begins October 1st and it will end on November 1st.
Okay, great. Great. I'll probably make sure I put that in the notes for the show. And you sent me some pages for some of the stories in there. Which one would you start talking about Trouble? Anything else you want to say about the Trouble story before we move on to some of the others?
That one was a lot of fun. Trouble, as always, is drawn by Schwenchen Bunag. His art is amazing. It looks like an anime movie. It's colored by Francine Appello, and she really uses some bright, colorful tones to bring it to life. And it's just a funny, silly little story. And it introduces a character that actually will be in Trouble number 2. Her name is Pinball, and she is one of Trouble's best friends. She's a 12-year-old computer hacker. It's just a funny, cute little story.
Okay, great. And you said there's 7 stories in the book?
I believe that there are 5 this year. Okay. Let me list them, and we'll know for sure. All right, so there's Lucy and the Doombringers Part 2. There's Trouble versus Cthulhu. There's Fukushu, which I don't think I sent you pages of, but it is a... that one is by Frederick B. Roseman, and it is a Japanese ghost story, mafia story, that came out really, really well. It's in black and white with red highlights for, like, all the blood. That one's a little bit gory. All right, then we have Fever Dreams, we have Brunch, and we have the second part of the Moloch Enoch story. So, yeah, that's 6. I think it's 6 this year.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's good. And it's going to be out in time for Halloween?
It will be. Now, I'm working on all the lettering right now, so I think I have like 8 pages left that need to get lettered, and then we're mostly set to go on that. We don't have the official cover yet. I've been circulating the cover, which is like a joke cover of Trouble versus Cthulhu, and that will be featured in the book as a splash page, a pinup. But yeah, the actual cover will be another Lucy and the Doombringers cover. And that one is a 16-page story. That will be the lead story, the first story in the book.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about that one then, Lucy and you said the Doombringers?
Yes. They first appeared in 13th Moon Volume 1. They were the cover story in that one. And Lucy is the daughter of the devil, and she escaped hell where she was grounded for 1,000,000 years. And... she joined a metal band, and Lucy and the Doombringers, I think it was only in the last page or two that they really came together as a band in that first volume. But this story is going to be about them going on tour for their first tour. And it's another comedy, horror comedy type of thing. And so you'll get two comedies in this volume, and then the other 4 are pretty gritty.
Okay, and she's the daughter of the devil, huh?
Yes, she is. She has horns on her head, and she's kind of a bodacious, badass lady, and... she plays a flying V guitar, and basically she was grounded in hell, and she was just shredding her guitar for 1,000,000 years, so she got pretty good at it. So now that she's on Earth, she linked up with a couple of humans who are also into metal music, and they're going to go on tour this year, and they're going to run into some nefarious bloodsuckers. So it's going to be Lucy and the Doombringers versus some vampires.
Okay, how many pages is in that story?
That one will be 16 pages.
16 pages. That's a 16-page one. Okay. So that's the first one in the book, sounds like. What's the second one? It sounds like you pretty much covered that pretty well. What's the second story in the book?
That'll be Trouble versus Cthulhu. It kind of goes in order of, like, how many pages there are, and that one is the next one in terms of length.
Okay. So that's that one. Then what follows that one?
Then we'll have Fukushu. Which is the one I mentioned. It's like a Japanese ghost story / Yakuza story. That one's a lot of fun. Some kind of violent gore in it, but an uplifting tale of a vengeful ghost.
Uplifting tale of a vengeful ghost. Okay. Something to look forward to. And you wrote that one as well, right?
No, Frederick B. Roseman wrote that one. And actually, it's like a story he did like 10 years ago, and that he was looking at his art, and he knows he got so much better. So this year, he started redrawing all the pages. I really liked what he was working on, and we put it in this volume.
Okay, great. Great. Sounds good. And, okay. All right. So that's the third one. What is next?
Brunch. Brunch is takes place in Los Angeles. It is the story of a young lady who is getting harassed and stalked around Los Angeles during Sunday morning brunch. And it starts at a rooftop brunch and kind of goes from there. And it's kind of more of a psychological paranormal thriller. And it's only six pages, but it's a lot packed into those six pages. And I really like the unique art on that. It's Ben DeMaio is a friend of mine from Philadelphia who did the artwork on that one. And I really like how that one came out.
Oh, good. Now, if that follows what I've got, that's four pages, right?
I might have sent you four pages to preview, but I believe it should be five or six pages total.
Okay, yeah, maybe you're right. Five. Five looks about right for me. Five for that. Now, it actually ends kind of disturbingly, shall we say.
Yes, very much so. I like that one. It starts out with, like, you know, the tension. You see, like, what this woman is worried about, and everyone else in the city isn't quite as tuned into what she's tuned into. Because Stalker is, like I said, paranormal and for her eyes only.
So what's the girl's name? Or does she have one?
Margaret? I think it's Margaret. It's okay. Lydia and Margaret, I think, are the two characters. They're two women having brunch, and I think it's Margaret.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Margaret's in there. I see that in there. So all kinds of wild doings in there. You can always expect the unexpected in your stories, Phoebe, that's for sure. So that one. So I take it that's a one-shot story. There won't be any further stories about what happens after that?
No, that's a one-off.
Okay, so that's a good one for that. And then what comes next after brunch?
Oh, Fever Dreams actually might be before brunch. And Fever Dreams is a four or five page story that's set in outer space, and it's kind of like a biological body horror kind of alien that is a threat that they find. These space marine type people find when they're exploring the ship, this abandoned ship, and it kind of goes from there.
Yeah, it ends rather horrifically again.
Yes.
So very interesting.
That one is the launch for Christopher McCulley's. I think it might be the whole thing might be called Dark Fever or Dark Dreams or something. But he did a role playing game based on that, and has maybe a book I think that he's coming out with based on that as well. But that is not a standalone. That is definitely the start of a whole universe.
Oh boy, okay, so that's just kicking off what we can expect. So, wow.
Yes.
Is that going to continue in your books, or is that going to transfer over to his books?
That will be all on stuff that he's publishing with other people other than this story. We just have this one intro story, and then the rest is with a different publisher.
Okay, cool. Very cool. It's nice of you guys to support each other and kind of help each other with those kinds of things. So
yeah,
that's great. Okay.
I love to support my team, and not everything that all the artists that I work with comes out on 123 Go Publications. I'm lucky to work with the people I work with when I do, but I also support their work when it's outside of the scope of 123 Go.
Okay. All right. So we've got Fever Dreams, and what happens after Fever Dreams in the book?
In our book?
Yes.
I believe, actually, that brunch will be after Fever Dreams. And Brunch will be the final story.
Okay, well, what happened to the Malik story?
Oh, shnikes. You know what? That is going to be like the third or fourth. You're right. I forgot about that.
Okay.
Oh,
so tell us what's going on with Malik.
Okay. Malik, this story arc started in 13th Moon Volume 2. And it's actually going to be three parts. There will be a part three in Volume 4. And it's about during the age of Enoch, or the book of Enoch in the Bible. I know it's a non-canonical book, but it's a story that comes from the biblical ages. And it tells the story of the sons of God who mated with the daughters of man, which basically means angels marrying humans and having babies with them, and that their babies were these giants. The Nephilim, or whatever is what they're called. And so that's like an actual existing story that we are doing our version of, that in the first chapter, in volume 2 of 13th Moon, you saw this baby, Anak, and A-N-A-K is how that's spelled. and that he was he had an angel for a dad and a human mom, and his dad died fighting Malak, and then his mom was kind of cursed to turn into a statue, turned to stone at the end of that first one. So this is then, but what the mother did before she turned to stone was she hid her baby with a cyclops. So there's this big old cyclops guy that's been raising her baby, and he's kind of manipulative in that he's raising the baby to be a weapon to fight against humans, because he despises the humans because they've wiped out most of his race, the cyclopses. So as a fellow giant, Anak is going to grow up to be a giant. He is, yeah, teaching him to fight and then unleash him against the humans. And that will lead to part three, where Malak will have to come back, because essentially, I think he told God in the first one that, oh, yep, I killed that baby, even though he didn't really want to kill the baby. So he kind of let the woman trick him. She gave him an effigy, which was made out of clay or something, and he destroyed that. And then he kind of knew, I think, in that moment that it wasn't the real baby, but he just didn't really love his role as God tells me to kill babies, I got to kill babies. And it's kind of some character development for Malak that we see that in this age of when God is using him as a destroyer, that he does do a lot. He destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. He did other things for God, but he doesn't relish all of it. And he definitely resents having to kill innocent people, and especially having to kill an innocent baby. So yeah, Malak is going to be in the third one, though, chapter three, in a year or two, that there will be an actual showdown now between this baby that's half angel and half human, and Malak, who is all angel and all destroyer.
Okay, now it looks like here that the name of the Cyclops is Og.
Yes.
Is that the name of the...
Yes.
That's him, okay, because I saw OG, and so many times OG stands for other stuff, so I just want to make sure that the name is Og.
Yep, it is Og, and he's got bright green hair, and he is kind of a mean, cantankerous old Cyclops, but he's also a good warrior, so he trains young Anak to be a good warrior as well.
Okay, sounds like this is from the Apocrypha, or what the extra biblical stuff.
Yes, exactly. It's non-canonical, but it was an actual considered a gospel that at one point.
Okay, yeah, they sorted out after the time of Jesus. They sorted out what was considered canonical and what wasn't, and I think this got moved out of that at that point.
Yep, in 382, the Council of Nicaea, they pared it down from 90-some versions of the gospel to just five that basically tell the same story five times.
Okay, now how many chapters are in this Malak story?
Just three in this one, and this is part two.
Okay, so the third one will be a year from now?
Maybe about 2 years. I think we've been putting out 13th Moon on average once every 2 years.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. And you're writing most of it, but there's other people writing other ones too. So that's what kind of takes time, it sounds like.
Oh yeah. This is definitely an anthology that I open up to other creators. Trouble versus Cthulhu is the only story I wrote in this book. I edited a lot of the other ones, and I do lettering on a lot of the other ones. But the only one that I 100% wrote is Trouble versus Cthulhu.
Okay, and how do you pick the artist? Does the writer pick the artist, or do you as the editor choose the artist? How do you do that?
It varies, but Joseph Cervellin wrote Brunch, and him and I worked on that story idea for probably a month or so until we got the script the way we wanted it. And then I had more than one artist lined up to be like, hey, maybe we could work with this one person, maybe we could work with this person. But I really liked the work that Ben had done for me in Gunmetal Black Ops number 4, Ben did a story, and I like how that came out, and they have a very distinctive kind of weird funky style. And I talked to Joseph, I was like, I really think this will be great for Brunch. And when all was said and done, I think that came out, that was a perfect match between that story and that artist.
So it's nice that you get to stretch both muscles. As a writer, you get to write longer stories apparently, and you also get to write short stories, because sometimes in comics, you know, so many stories go on and on and on for years, and we never get the end. But it's nice that you actually have short stories as well as longer tales. So I think that's a great thing that you do.
Thank you. And yeah, as far as the artist for the Malak stories, all of Malak's stories so far that we've been doing since 2018 have all been drawn by JMA, Juan Manuel Almayron, and he is magnificent. And hope to continue working with him on all things Moloch.
Okay, very good. Now, if people, for some reason, can't support you during Kickstarter, do you guys have a website, or is there other places to access your comics?
Oh, yeah. So, in general, when you want to find my comic books and also my short story collection, they're all available right now on indieplanet.com/123go. And a few of them are even available. If it says sale, that means that it's available for a free download for the digital version. So there's a couple free ones up there, including Trouble Number One. And go ahead and download some of that today. And if you don't have a dollar or two, can't contribute to a Kickstarter, we have some free books available for you.
Okay, and that's good. So how long have you guys been doing 123go?
I think the first time I printed a book was 2018, and but at that point too, it had probably been 3 years to make that first comic book. We've gotten a little bit better at it, maybe can get some of these books done a little bit quicker, but in general I would say it's a slow, long process for each issue. It could take a year, it could take 3 years for us to get a full book out, and there's no real rush. It's more about getting the end product the way we want it, and getting it done at our pace, because everybody involved mostly has other jobs that they got to tend to.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with indie comics. You kind of do it when you can. And that's a nice thing for that to do. You guys have real-time jobs. Or reality gets in the way of making comics every once in a while, sounds like.
Yeah, for sure. And then, sometimes, I don't get the colored pages until a week or two before I want to publish it. And then I got to rush my lettering. So I actually started lettering all the Cthulhu pages before I had the final colors, so that I could just pop the finished TIFF in when I get it from my colorist. So we're actually in really good shape right now, just about done with all the letters and ready to launch.
Oh boy, it's going to be good to get this out around the Halloween time, because it's kind of like Christmas in the sense that you put out Halloween stuff after Halloween. People aren't quite as interested in it. It's like Christmas stories. The day after Christmas, you can forget putting any more Christmas stuff out because people aren't interested in it, basically. It's over. So you're doing a smart, wise thing by getting this out as early as you can.
Thank you. I've also been told that this month on Kickstarter is what's known as the gauntlet, that this is the hardest time to sell anything on Kickstarter, and it's the last time to get your projects in before Christmas, because after October 31st, all money basically is getting spent on Christmas stuff.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. There's a lot of people who don't do anything during December because of Christmas, and then they just start up again in January because it's post-Christmas and people start getting money again. So, yeah, that's what I keep hearing about that. But is November also a bad month? The way you're describing it, November isn't a good time either.
From what I understand, November is probably one of the worst months to launch a Kickstarter.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? Because I keep hearing December, but this is the first time I've heard November is also a bad month. So you're smart to get that done by November 1.
Yeah. I mean, it might not be as hard as December, but I would say right after December is November as far as which months are hard to launch in.
Wow. Because there seems to be a certain time of the year that seems that Kickstarter's just coming a bunch, and then all of a sudden they stop. Because I can tell, because I don't get as many requests for the podcast, so I have to be really careful and pay attention to what's coming and make sure everything gets scheduled just right, because I want to support the Kickstarters like yours and stuff like that. So we want to make sure we get all the good things in there, and we get lots of good. Do you know what the goal is going to be for your Kickstarter yet?
I believe it's going to be around 1,200. All we're really trying to do is print and send the books and pay Bayron for his Lucy story. All other artists have been compensated pretty much already. So just giving him his page rate is the main goal of this Kickstarter.
Okay. I got to ask, though, have you been paying the other artists?
Yeah, mostly. Yeah, at least two of them I paid out of my pocket already. My colorist on Trouble and my line artist on Trouble, I paid them out of my pocket. The artist on Dark Fever, that's the first time he ever did any sort of comic book art, and Chris kind of brought him to me. and was like, hey, Phoebe, is this kid's art good enough to put in the book for my story? Because he wants to do it pro bono, just to have a story out. So that guy actually is going to get copies of the book as compensation. But yeah, otherwise, I pretty much have paid everybody except for Bayron at this point.
Wow. Okay. So you're invested in this book. That's what you're saying.
I mean, all my books are really like that. A lot of the stuff that you see up on IndiePlanet /123go, I mean, I paid for the line art and sometimes colors for all these pages that we never did a Kickstarter on most of those books. It's just up there now as an existing product that we completed. But for the most part, most of my books are just existing in a state of being available now, but that when it's a passion. So I wanted to get these comic books done, and I paid my art team.
Yeah. So how far in advance do you have to work to make these things happen on schedule? Because, you know, there's a lot of people out there who seem to be baffled by scheduling and stuff, but you seem to have it down to a pattern. How far in advance do you have to do things in order to get things out on time?
Well, I knew that I had a bunch of these stories like half done, or I think the art on Fever Dream was completely done. So maybe around last Halloween, because Volume 2 didn't succeed on Kickstarter, I only opened submissions to people who are already part of my team. I did not open any submissions to like new artists that are writers that I had never worked with before. So that's why it's only 6 stories this time, and it's all people that I've worked with before. Yeah, so I knew that we had everything pretty much worked out, and then I went to lunch with Bayron. What was it, maybe in December or January, either the end of last year or the beginning of this year, Bayron and I sat down for a lunch together, and he had some new Lucy ideas, and I was like, yeah, let's do this. I really wanted to do this. The only thing is I'm not going to necessarily have the cash up front, so we're going to have to kickstart this at the end, which he was okay with. He works as a tattoo artist during the day, so when he's sitting around at his shop and he doesn't have someone to tattoo, he's kind of sketching on his pad and been doing the pages while he's, you know, in his downtime. That was the last story that we added. Everything else was kind of already together by by New Year's. I kind of knew which ones were going in this. It has just been a matter of doing the lettering and some instances getting the coloring done. But yeah, a lot of the line art and all the stories were done for this by around New Year's. And, then it's been getting the Lucy pages done, getting the colors for Cthulhu done, Trouble First Cthulhu done, getting the colors for Moloch's story done. And I think Frederick needed a month or three in there to finish his Fukushu pages. But I think when he brought it to me, he was like, here's 5 pages that I've been redoing of my old art. So I think he already had half of that story drawn when he pitched it to me. So yeah, it could take up to a year. Sometimes longer than that. This Trouble versus Cthulhu story has been bubbling for maybe 3 or 4 years since I first pitched it to that different anthology, Cthulhu anthology. But yeah, sometimes I pitch to a bigger creator or a different anthology and I get it rejected, but I'm like, nope, I still like that story. So I'm going to pay an artist to draw it anyway and we'll find some place to print it.
See, it's good for people to hear that because I think a lot of people don't understand. I mean, you pick up a comic and, you know, it looks so easy. I mean, it's all together when you get the book. And people don't understand. It takes, you know, scheduling and working months in advance in order to get a book out for people to buy. So I'm glad that you told that story because I think a lot of people, particularly when they're using Kickstarter and things like that, it's good to have that kind of an understanding that this is going to take a while and you need to plan ahead to get that done. So I appreciate you telling that story.
Yeah, no worries. I actually kind of don't understand the people who are like, hey, on Kickstarter, give me $3,000 so I can pay the artist to start drawing it. I'm like, I don't go down Kickstarter until the book's done, basically. So yeah, these people that like want you to give them the money to then hire an artist, and then it's going to take 2 years to draw, and then what, you're going to get your rewards 2.5 years from then? And I guess some people are making it work, you know, so I can't totally like, you know, naysay it. But like to me, that just baffles me. That is not the way my process works.
Well, I've seen so many people on Kickstarter do that very thing. Hey, I got this great story. Give me money and I'll make it happen. And
years after, people still aren't doing it. There's a book that I supported in Kickstarter about 4 years ago, and a couple of months ago, the book finally showed up in my mailbox. And I was shocked to see it. I thought this was, they had given up on this one, but I actually got the book and I was really happy to see it. And if I receive the guy, I'm going to say, I appreciate you staying, being faithful to it and getting the book in my hands, because I was really concerned about this. I thought I was never going to see the light of day with that one, but you actually made it happen. So I was really pleased to see that in my mailbox.
Well, that's a success story, and I'm very happy to hear that for them. But yeah, in general, that's also kind of one of the built-in risks with Kickstarter, that they say, when you're putting this money into this project, just so you know, we do not guarantee that you're going to get your rewards. That we hope that this artist will follow through on it. And like, obviously, if there's someone who repeatedly doesn't follow through on the rewards, they're probably not going to be able to do their fourth or fifth Kickstarter. But yeah, personally, I don't really want to bring a project to Kickstarter unless it's at least 90% done.
That's good to hear, because like I said, I have been disappointed several times. There was a married couple that was doing a series of novels, and they were converting them into comics. And they had a personal problem come up in the middle of it, and they ended up using the money that people gave for the comics to pay for their personal stuff. And, you know, I understand the need for that, but on the other hand, the comics never saw the light of day, and so I'm kind of like, I'm kind of glad I haven't seen them doing any Kickstarters since then, because I would be slow to move on if in that case, because, you know, that's kind of frustrating when you do those things. Now, on the other hand, the thing about Kickstarter that's frustrating me these days is that comics seem to be becoming less and less of what's going out on Kickstarter. I mean, there is all kinds of stuff being Kickstarter these days, movies and TV shows and stuff around the house is being Kickstartered. And I'm going like, wow, I don't really see a whole lot of comics like I used to. So that's another reason I'm glad to see you're going to be on there, because it's nice to have one we know for sure is going to come through. So I'm happy to see it.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it is a shrinking market for comic books from what I understand. And I don't know if this trend has followed through to this past year, but I knew know that a year or two ago, board games were actually bigger than comic books. That you had a much better chance of getting your board game kickstarted than you did at getting your comic book kickstarted.
Wow. Well, let me ask you something, because this is an indie comics. I'm always interested in this. With the industry in the state that it's in right now, do you think that indie comics are more popular now or less popular than they were before the pandemic?
I think that there's always a market for it. As far as what's popular, I don't know. I know that like so much of the industry has been absorbed into Disney these days, and that Marvel is this weird big monster that produces all the TV shows and all the movies. So it's hard to get your indie shit recognized sometimes when there's so much of a big budget going into even their crappiest television shows. So I think the passion is still there for it, but I think getting your book visible is a lot harder these days. Even though, you know, we can all put it on Instagram, we can all put it on Facebook, we don't necessarily have the budget to then buy 1,000 clicks on Instagram or buy 1,000 shares on Facebook or whatever, that you can use their internal marketing kind of programs if you have the money to do that. So I would say that it's still a great, great, great landscape for creators, that you do have a fandom that is willing to search high and low for the weirdest indie stuff, but it's harder to get your stuff out there unless you have a great promo team, unless you're grinding on your making podcast appearances and posting on social media regularly. I have the fortune to work with Jeff, who works with me on publicizing these podcasts. I also, though, went out of my way and booked an extra two podcasts that people he's never talked to before, that I'm just like, all right, what other horror people can I find? What other, you know, who's my friend on Twitter that says they have a podcast? Okay, she's a nice lady. Let's do a podcast. Even if comic books isn't your main thing, Kickstarter isn't your main thing, you have 30,000 followers on Twitter. Let's talk. So yeah, you got to keep grinding. So I think it's hard to be in any creator in this day and age, but I think it's also, there's still a lot of good indie art out there.
Well, there's a creator by the name of Ron Randall, and he does a book called Trekker. And he hired some consultant. And the one thing he felt comfortable sharing with me was that the person said, if you're not out on the internet and promoting your stuff so much that it makes you uncomfortable, you're not doing enough.
That's absolutely right.
That was really interesting advice. Yeah. I had not heard anybody say that before, but so many people, when I say that to them, I say, that's right. That's exactly right. And he honestly, right now, his Trekker is so successful is that he is making he does it, and he puts all his time and effort into Trekker, and he is, from what I understand, he doesn't need any other jobs and stuff like that. He can do Trekker and do Kickstarter and other crowdfunding stuff, and he can make it happen and do other things too, and he's good to go.
That's awesome. Very good on him. But that is absolutely a great way to describe it, because I personally have been blessed that through my friends, my social network on Facebook and Twitter, that usually I'm able to find enough support from my friends to carry me over the finish line. Yes, I still get like 30 to 40% that's generated inside the Kickstarter algorithms, but I have never had this experience where like, oh, you hit 40% within your first 2 days, the algorithms are going to carry you to victory, which I know for some people it works that way. And you become one of their, project they like or this or that, and they highlight you. But last time, I think it was when I was promoting the Vikings book, that I did a podcast that was like a four-person roundtable kind of thing. And one of the guys that was on that roundtable, I saw him on his Facebook like a week after we had all talked. And he was like, okay, so here's the stats on Kickstarter this week. And yes, there was $300,000 put into comic book projects. However, when I break it down further, those comic book projects that are getting that $300,000, $280,000 of those dollars went to projects attached to Image, IDW, or like Marvel even, that like, yes, they're Kickstarters, but they're Kickstarters attached to huge companies that have their own built-in marketing and their own built-in fan base, that like, it's a lot harder to fail on Kickstarter when you're part of Black Horse or, you're part of an established indie icon. So he was like, yeah, there's all this money going into comic books, but the amount that actually trickles down to us, like totally independent, not working with any bigger company creators, is very tiny compared to the lion's share of how much money gets invested in comic books on Kickstarter. And so that's kind of another debate for us all to have maybe at another time or ongoing, is like, should big rock stars and like big industry successful writers be kickstarting their albums and kickstarting their books when the tiny indie person is struggling to get their stuff kickstarted?
That's definitely something we should approach, because boy, I we need as much help as we can to keep the comic industry going. So Phoebe, if people want to follow you on the internet, where do they go for that?
I would say you can follow me on Instagram, Phoebe 123Go. My Twitter is mostly for sports and politics. You can follow us on Facebook, though. That's a good place to follow 123Go Publications. You can look us up. We do have a Facebook where Kickstarters are featured, and just in general, new books or any projects by anyone that's on the 123Go team, we'll get some support there.
Okay.
And just in general, if you want any of our books, go to indieplanet.com/123Go. There's some free downloads, and even the digital ones that you pay, it's like 99 cents for a 24-page PDF. That's a pretty good deal as far as I'm concerned. And I have my short story collection up there these days, Superliminal Latency. That's a 17-story short story collection, I think 287 pages. So we have a lot of books out there in the ether, and if you're interested, come get some. And we do hope that some of you listeners come and support us on the Kickstarter. It's going to be a really fun Halloween book.
All right. Again, it's 13th Moon Anthology, Volume 3.
And Phoebe, I wish you all a lot of success, because I think the indie market is good for the comics industry, and I know that the stuff you're doing is going to help make the industry move into the future. So keep it up.
Thank you, Wayne.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance. And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.